online, offline, bottom line. Sendoff.net.
Welcome back, everybody, to Sundog the Podcast. It's the show where we talk about everything related to marketing plus technology. And hopefully by the end of the show, we'll give you something that you can take away to help improve your company's bottom line. I'm Chief Editor here at Sundog Studios, Lon Keller, and we have a couple gentlemen joining us today. We're going to be talking about Salesforce and the latest news in that world. We're going to start by introducing our Executive Vice President of Technology, Jonathan Rademacher.
Good morning.
How are you doing? And we're also joined by our Chief Operating Officer, Eric Dukart.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you guys?
Good.
Thanks for joining us today. And we just kind of wanted to get caught up on what's new in the world of Salesforce. Let's start with Chatter and how here at Sundog we've started to use it more and more as an internal communication tool. The latest trend I personally have seen lately is it's taking away the email traffic and putting, you know, primarily our internal business communications squarely within Chatter to kind of help keep your email box a little bit cleaner.
Yeah, we were a very early adopter of Chatter. It's actually less than a year old, and about a year old, they released the beta program, and we were building something similar for our internal professional services automation tool, which was Chatter-esque or Twitter-esque, if you will. But we decided to jump on and try the beta, and we've been on it for 12 months internally, and I think it's changed the way that we communicate quite a bit. You can think of Chatter kind of a walled garden of Facebook and Twitter, where you can safely send documents back and forth. You can interact with your colleagues without being concerned that it's going to be let out on the internet. I know you can do the same thing if you do a protected Twitter group or if you try and do security around Facebook, but this also allows the logging and auditing and some of the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements for public companies, but really logs all that. So we have a history of all of our communication, much like we do with email.
But one of the things I think is pretty interesting is if you look at the innovation track that Salesforce is going down, they talk a lot about leveraging the consumer network to kind of drive a lot of what's happening on the business side. And I think they've been pretty much dead on with the approach that they're taking. If you take an organization that one of the biggest challenges that we see in companies is communication and how do you maintain proper communication within a company? And Chatter, I think, enables that. Some of the other unique aspects that we use Chatter for, again, is not only just collaboration within team members and people within the company, but also being able to keep updated on content that's floating around your company, ability to tag content, ability to put content into workspaces, and leveraging Chatter to collaborate on the changes that are happening there. I think that's been one of kind of the other main takeaways that we've learned through our implementation of leveraging their collaboration platform to really help streamline and move our business forward.
Yeah, and if you think about the differences between a Twitter or a Facebook way to communicate versus email, Salesforce themselves are saying that their email has gone down by 50%, and that's great. I guess the benefit that I see is the ability to ask the question to a group of experts. You know, at Sundog, we push expertise. So we've got groups of mobile experts, groups of tablet experts, and if I need to ask a question, I'm not sending this email blast to seven people hoping somebody's going to respond, and all of a sudden I end up on a thread with one person because they didn't hit reply all, and it screws up how all that flows. Instead, I can say, hey, we're looking at a new iOS project, and it's going to need to be formatted for an iPad, and we're going to do this. It'll be hosted in Amazon. What do you guys think? And instantly, I start getting feedback, and I start getting these conversations going, which I don't get when I use email. I don't feel.
But I think one of the things that we've all been experiencing as we've been talking about getting Chatter rolled out for our clients is the main question is, well, how do we do it? And how do I not get overwhelmed with the amount of information that's flowing around? And so the platform's there, but there's still that need to be able to think through the process of how you're going to use it. So predefined tags as to how you're going to tag information inside, developing the right amount of work groups, making sure that people understand information that they should be putting on their corporate profile, but then also how do they leverage groups and how do they make sure that the information they're putting inside groups makes the most sense. So there's still a plan that needs to be put in place. And with the clients we've been working with that are just starting to roll out this communication platform, you do need to do that planning ahead of time.
You definitely do. I think the interesting part is because it is such a new technology and a new way to communicate, we look more to the consumer world to understand how they're doing it. Mark Benioff at Salesforce called it the Facebook imperative because he felt that Facebook was the ultimate way to communicate. So we look at how people use Facebook, and I've asked a number of colleagues, how often do you use email anymore in your personal life? And they said, well, I never check my email. Well, how often do you check Facebook? Well, constantly. I use Facebook messaging. I use this. Well, okay. So if you don't use email any longer and you're completely consumed in Facebook, how can we leverage that to work better as a team and not use email in the business? And that's really, I think, the Facebook imperative. And we're still learning from that. We've set up groups. We've looked at how people use Facebook, how they use Twitter, and we've mirrored a lot of that over. And I think we've gained a lot of efficiency, but there's still more to gain.
What also is interesting is think about your use of Facebook, your use of email, and what you're doing on your phone now. I mean, if I look at the amount of email that I'm reading, whether it's email, my Facebook account, my Twitter posts that I'm subscribed to, that's all coming out through my phone, and I'm looking at it more likely on my phone than I'm on my laptop. So, mm-hmm. I think some of the innovations that Salesforce is doing with Chatter to make sure that it is working on devices, on pads, is going to be even more critical this year.
Is email basically going to become more or less an external communication tool solely? Do you see is that the path where you see it taking?
I don't know. I think it's going to be used for different types of communication. We've been breaking that down and dissecting it from a social standpoint. If we think about urgency, right? The most urgent thing for me to do is sneaker net. I walk up to your desk, I tap you on the shoulder, and I mm-hmm. get your strict attention. The next one that seems to evolve is IM. Right, IM means I'm more urgent than an email.
Right,
right. I need your attention. I need it now. Email can maybe be flagged for follow up, and a phone also mixes in there somewhere in there. But I don't really see as much phone as I see IM these days. And so we're trying to figure out where does Chatter fit into this, and we look at the consumer world where it's email has fallen off the chain. Now it's Twitter and Facebook are number one and number two. So we're trying to slide it in there and see if that works well, but also being flexible enough to swap out and go back to email if it works for specific business situation.
Yeah, I think again, Chatter is a collaboration engine. So using that channel versus email versus IM is really around, do you want to get group information? Do you want to push out group information and receive group information back?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. It's a meeting mechanism. So I would almost look at it like email is point to point. So mm-hmm. if we look at the email versus IM versus telephone, that's a point to point. Maybe Chatter is, I'm going to use Chatter instead of setting up a meeting. Most urgent would be, let's have a meeting, let's have a round table. Second way to look at it is, hey, I'm going to ask my group of experts.
I'm personally liking how groups are working. We had a tech talk internally here at Sundog a couple of weeks ago, rolling out more and more of the features of Chatter and internal promotion to use the tool for ourselves even more. And one of the first groups that was created was revolved around our smartphones that we all have here and how to it's basically like a knowledge sharing place instead of just a spot to ask Anthony questions, and then Anthony's our IT guy, by the way, ask him questions. But the nice thing is if someone can ask him a question, you can see what the question is, and you come to the realization, oh yeah, that pertains to me too. So it actually can cut down on overall communication just by watching somebody else's conversation on a particular topic, and it gets those ideas spread faster throughout a company.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent case study.
Yeah, and hasn't it been interesting how much quicker your question gets answered?
Yes.
Now that you've got it in the group.
Right,
right.
And let's say, for example, Anthony's not around. Another one of our mobile experts, Paul, probably knows the answer too, and he'll chime in and answer.
but you're asking the group. And so we, with the Android mobile user group that we put together, multiple people are looking to chime in because now they're using the technology. They're getting passionate about it. They say, hey, I figured that out on my own. So I'm going to go ahead and share that with the group. Another one is that I've noticed just spawning quite a lot is the marathon. So we've got the marathon coming up in May. We set up various relay groups and all of a sudden we see all this chatter going back and forth and focusing that that message and simplifying it has been great.
Do you have any insights or predictions as to what Salesforce's recent purchase of DimDim is? It's a video conferencing service, and how that could roll into future chatter offerings?
Well, I think what Salesforce is doing is continue to extend that collaboration and really looking at video conferencing as the next evolution of collaboration. Mm-hmm. Again, within an organization, being able to push information out, whether that's documents or videos, but now I think with DimDim, the next evolution of that is going to be more real-time collaboration, and that's the strategy they have behind that acquisition in our view.
I also think you have to look at the consumer world and look at how quickly these things are evolving and looking at how Facebook is leveraging their network for doing voice over IP, trying to really bypass some of the other places where you'd Skype or et cetera, FaceTime. And I see the same thing replicating into the business world. Business world is typically a couple steps behind the consumer world as far as speed. And I think that's where you're going to see the DimDim piece come in. So again, I've got this walled garden where I can easily IM, I can video chat. It's something that Microsoft's been putting together as part of their Dynamics package. If you look at how Office integrates with it, it's part mm-hmm. of how Google does their Office package. They've got Google right. Voice. And so it's really going after that market share, but it's a seamless integration. And the neat part about both of these is how quickly they can be set up and they can be tested. So I think in the old world where it's this huge initiative to bring on a new way to communicate via voice, so I got to buy a whole bunch of Cisco hardware and I've got to have a very dedicated specialist to figure out how it works. In this scenario, it's flip it on and it works.
Let's shift gears to another one of the more recent offerings from Salesforce, which is database.com. What excites you, both of you, about this new product offering?
Well, I think when they unveiled it at Dreamforce and we had an opportunity to kind of kick the tires on a little bit, what's interesting, again, is that this is an enterprise cloud database, meaning no hardware, no software. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the major differentiators here that they're looking at with database.com. And again, it rounds out their package or their suite with the platform. One of the challenges as a developer on top of that platform we have is having a true database that we can connect to, that we have access to the tables, et cetera. So I think it fits perfectly in their roadmap where they're moving. From a company and from our client perspective, what we're seeing is now that ability to not only build applications on top of the platform, but be able to store their data a little more robust than we have in the past.
I think that the keys are with database.com, it's not necessarily what, but how. So it's nothing. There's nothing really revolutionary about what database.com is doing. What it is revolutionary about is I can set up a very robust database in an hour that scales as much as I'd like it to, and it's extremely cost effective. So the economies of scale are very hard to touch with an on-premise solution. Also, the security model that's built into it. You've got very robust industry-leading security that you wouldn't get if you're trying to just build this on your own. And in the old way of building on-premise software, you sort of build this standalone server and you hope it works. And then unfortunately, one of your biggest fears is that you're going to be wildly successful and you're going to outscale your hardware before you can catch up with it. With this sort of elastic environment, you're always going to have that capacity. It's really interesting.
And I think one of the things that every organization is going to be thinking about is when you have an enterprise cloud database, you're going to have your on-premise databases. Those aren't going to go away. So the model you really need to be thinking through is how are you going to integrate that cloud database with your on-premise? And so the
two will still exist simultaneously, or
in enterprises, I think they're going to.
Okay,
for large enterprises, I think.
Why is that?
I think that so the economies of scale start to lend themselves to very large organizations. Mm-hmm. So for a small company, it doesn't make any sense to try and do this on your own or host it yourself.
Sure.
When you get into the billion-dollar company where they can actually have that focused expertise, they can start to match some of those economies of scale, and it starts to make sense. Mm-hmm. I still think they're going to leverage some of the cloud providers, but they can actually come up with a business case to say, I'm going to dedicate 300 people to managing a complex infrastructure.
It's going to continue to move that way, but corporations are going to keep their ERP in-house. And I think the opportunity with database.com is going to be, from Sundog's standpoint, the clients we work with, is taking those sales and marketing initiatives and being able to put them into a cloud database. So now the question comes back to us, well, how do I pass that data back and forth? And Salesforce does a very good job with their APIs to make sure that you can move that data between the two apps. Again, I'll go back to, the technology is there. It's a lot, 5 times faster, a lot easier to be able to develop in, but you still have to have a sound strategy. You still have to have a sound architecture to make sure that everything that you are moving back and forth, you maintain the data integrity, data quality.
You actually have to be 10 times better, it seems like. So if you can't just compare yourself to an on-premise and say we're equal, you have to take it to the nth level. If you look at security around the Salesforce environment, around the database.com environment, they are beyond paranoid. And the reason for that is if they lose 1 ounce of data from one company, their trust is lost. And you when you've got an internal system, sort of like, oh, you know, there was an issue, we remedied it, we figured it out, we're moving forward. They don't have that sort of luxury. So the security levels they go through and the certifications are world class to make sure that they can be a viable solution for all companies. And us as technical consultants, we are there to give sound technical advice, and we also have to kick the tires on and make sure that we're confident in it.
One of the marketing points Salesforce uses for database.com is they say that it has row level security. Could you explain what that is and how that fits into their security strategies?
I think so row level security is granular security down to the actual row of the actual table that you're putting together.
Okay.
So it's very, very granular security. So it's not just I'm giving you access, and you've purchased a few tables, right? Mm-hmm. You've created them and you have access to it. It means that you can have a hierarchical model so that you can say, I'm the president of X company. I've got a marketing division. I've got a sales division. I'm going to store both of their data in this database.com, but neither one of them can see each other's data. So I can have fine grain security around both of those. So read, update, delete, level security at the field level. This is common for most all on-premise databases, but it's hard to scale when you're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of companies being on the same database platform.
How do you maybe walk through some of the benefits, how row-level security within a database along with your row-level security within an application, you know, what are some of the advantages that Salesforce is going to be able to see from that, from your perspective?
So tying that back into the security model that Salesforce uses, they've got a very robust hierarchical security model. So back to, I've got maybe people that are a salesperson at a dealership, and that dealership is part of a larger corporation, and there's regional managers and district managers, et cetera. The ability to have row-level security out at the most leaf level, so at a salesperson, out at a dealership, they own one record, and that record is accessible to them and not the salesperson sitting in the cube next to them. But it is accessible to the manager at that dealership as part of a roll-up, but it's not accessible to another dealership in another state. And then as we roll up to the district, it's accessible at the district, but not at the region. So all of that roll-up data gives me real-time access to sales information, marketing information, all these things that used to take months and months to put together and to come up with your annual operating plan or to come up with what the ROI was for a specific sales strategy. All that's done in real-time. And that's really what, starting at the field level security, rolling up and leveraging a hierarchical security model allows you to take care of it. So
there's still a lot of technical work that needs to be done.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Cloud computing, the way I see it, is older than most people think. Dating myself a little bit here, but when I first started getting on to computers, it was a dumb terminal that was hooked via phone line, mm-hmm. that you had to put the handset in the little receiver there, and it connected to a remote server. In my case, it was a college that was like 25 miles away.
You were in War Games, weren't you?
could have been. Oregon Trail ring a bell to anybody? That's how we killed a lot of time. In your opinion, what caused that shift from that model to the local, having the desktop box and all your information stored locally? And why is it now going back again? I mean, do you see it moving to the cloud and then back again? I mean, are we just going back and forth all the time here? What's changed?
Cost. That's been the big thing. When you were dialing into the mainframes, et cetera, you're paying for MIPS, which mm-hmm. are computer cycles. So mm-hmm. you're paying for raw usage, which is actually what we're going back to. But you paid a phenomenal amount to do that. So when the first computer came out and it was $10,000 and you could compute whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted, this was a great thing. MIPS, again, not only were they high cost, but you only got certain blocks to be able to use those that time. So that was way back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. As we evolved...
Not that old, by the way.
So as we evolved and started doing Telnet and things like that, which was more unlimited access for $20, it was great, but the bandwidth wasn't there. So the shift of computing power was put onto the computer or the handset or whatever we're using today. The reason for that shift was, number one, that the pipes weren't big enough, right, to transfer the data to give you a rich experience. And number two, the cost benefit made sense to go and buy a computer for $2,000 and buy the software and have it all locally and be able to connect at 56.6 and upload my email or download a web page. Now I'm connecting at 25 meg. I mean, I've got a 25 meg connection at home. I can stream video. I have really no need to buy most robust applications at home for gaming. I just plug in and I can play remotely. Sure. So the benefits are that you sort of centralize that control back into the mainframe, if you will, and your economies of scale go down so dramatically. It's funny, if we look at hosting a website these days on a traditional server that we've got on premise, the cost that compared to doing it on, say, an Amazon environment where they've got thousands of servers and they've optimized them for performance and uptime is 10 to 1. It's orders of magnitude difference.
But I think from a business perspective, the other aspect is just ease of doing business. You don't need to have people that are experts in the network, people that are experts in the hardware, the software. So I think this shift back to the cloud computing model is, again, from a business perspective, is if you look at the bottom line and are saying, where do I want to spend my money? Mm-hmm. You know, have that money be spent in people that are doing the job that they're supposed to be. So I think, along with the technology innovations that are coming, the fact that cloud computing has made it easier for businesses to be able to use it, I think that's what's making that shift happen now.
And I think it's here to stay. I don't think we're going to go back to it. And so there's a number of reasons for it. One is a number of ways you access the internet. You've got your phone, you've got your computer, you've got a tablet. Mm-hmm. How difficult it is to synchronize those things, without having just a cloud repository, just your contacts. I just want to send an email and I meet you on the street and I get your email and I put it in my phone and I get home and I want to email you again. What do I have to do? I got to look it up in my phone. I got to key it into my computer. What do I do? So I think that these are more portals into a virtual you, if you will. And I think it's going to become more ubiquitous with your car being connected, with your refrigerator being connected, all these things. And the technology is catching up with things like HTML5, where we're not doing installed apps like we maybe would before. It's still going to be around for a while, but having sort of this application framework that any app can work in is the vision.
That kind of leads me into my next question. Businesses can save a lot of money, no hardware on site. But then they were, a concern I had when cloud computing really started to get going here over the last few years was, well, what if your internet dies? Then you have no more connection. But JR, you just brought up the great point where you can access it with your phone, with your iPad, with your Galaxy Tab. I mean, there's other services out there that you probably have that you don't even realize. I mean, you've already got a backdoor into something if your main internet goes down for an hour.
I think the reality is we're getting to a point where computers are not useful if they're not connected. If you look at an I've been using an iPad for the past couple months, and we purchased the Wi-Fi models just because we didn't feel that they were fast enough to use the 3G. But it's really a useless tool when I'm outside of Wi-Fi. I really have no mm-hmm. use for that. My laptop, unless I'm authoring a document, is pretty useless without an internet connection. I think we've become dependent on that constant flow. The other example I was going to discuss was games, but those are all connected too. I mean, how often are you going to play a game these days where you don't want to have some sort of online presence with it so I can play against someone, unless you're playing solitaire at home, right?
Mm-hmm. But I think again, the thought of my internet going down, that's a risk of having a cloud platform. But that risk against, again, maintaining servers, maintaining software version updates, etc. I mean, I don't know, and Anthony's our great IT manager, so I'm glad I don't ever know that our internet's down, but our internet doesn't go down. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really how businesses are operating now.
You know, the concept we talked about before, I think on a previous podcast, was about cloud computing in general, and the example that it's utility computing, and that was the great idea that came from the mainframe, but it's starting to peek its head again. But I believe, you know, it's already getting to that point, but it's as important as electricity. We see some governance around it, but the reality is that it's going to be just like turning on a faucet in your house, and if water didn't come out, what would happen? I think that's akin to what you will do in 5 years if your internet's not up.
Are there cost benefits to cloud computing when it comes to developing updates for programs that are out there? Is it cheaper to implement them?
There are tremendous updates, and I think that's part of what drives the cost of cloud computing down. You know, what version of Photoshop are you on right now?
CS5.
You're on CS5, okay. Mm-hmm. If you call in, and so you're on Snow Leopard on your Mac.
Leopard on these.
And you've got a what kind of computer are you running?
Quad core.
Okay.
Power.
So when
you're
putting
me to sleep.
So,
sorry.
So when you have an issue, I have to explain this quickly. Mm-hmm. When you have an issue with Photoshop and you call into Adobe, you mm-hmm. have to explain all those things.
Right.
And they have to troubleshoot it against every version of every hardware configuration and mm-hmm. computer you have. With a cloud computer offering, you call up and you say, it doesn't work. And they say, what browser are you using? And that's it. And if that. So mm-hmm. I have to, I'm only supporting one version. I'm not supporting CS5, CS6, CS3. I'm supporting, you know, spring of 2011, and I support certain browsers, but it's much easier to code a patch. The downfall of it is, you know, and this goes into how you actually architect your software, is that when everybody moves to a new version, they all move.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, testing and making sure that everything works well and making sure that you properly coded your software is very important at that point. So you know that's only really going to break once, and that's when if you have an issue when you upgrade.
I think one of the other interesting things we've learned over the last few years of both implementing in a custom software development cycle versus in a cloud platform is that the amount of time that we're spending at the front end of projects doing requirements gathering, doing architecture, and kind of laying out exactly how we're going to build has extended, but our development cycles have gone down significantly. In the custom development world, a lot of we were allocating a lot more time to being spent in the development cycles and the QA cycles and then having to do fixes and changes. That cycle time has all gone down, but we've applied a lot more to that to the front half of projects where we're nailing down exactly what the need is for the business. So I think the value that our clients are seeing out of the applications have gone up because we get to spend more time nailing down additional functionality that they're looking for.
So I think the business value has gone up quite a bit because we're solving business problems instead of solving technical problems.
Specifically, what type of problems have we solved already? What are some of the products that we've developed with Salesforce?
Some important ones are really around the sales and marketing process, which we're a marketing and technology company, so that's fitting. But lead routing. So if I'm coming in and I type in a postal code, we want to get you associated with the right person. Doing scoring around leads. So lead scoring models, so that not only am I someone at a website typing in my postal code, but where else have I been on that website? Am I someone that is a hot lead or a cold lead? How should I interact with them? Should I nurture them? Some of the other pieces are around surveys.
I mean, some of the things that we've worked on is sales process. And if you've got a large sales organization, how do you make sure that sales organization is all selling the same model? So stage gate processes, not allowing someone to move somebody through a different stage of the sales process until certain activities have happened, and mapping that activity back into content that's being stored inside the app. Another kind of key process, I think, that we spent a lot of time on is campaign management. Again, being a marketing company, we do a lot of marketing activities, but making sure that those campaigns are structured in a way that all of the information is rolling up, all the dollars are rolling up so that you can get to a true marketing ROI. I think all of those pieces, again, are lending ourselves to spending more time on solving business needs as opposed to, as JR said, solving technology issues that we've had, because the platform just works now.
All right, JR, Eric, thank you very much for joining us today. If anyone out in the listening audience has a question for our panelists, you can send an email to thepodcast@sundog.net. For JR, Eric, I'm Lon Keller, and we'll catch you next time on Sundog, the podcast.